24-year-old Jennifer Kessy disappeared January 24, 2006. She was last seen at her condo on Conroy Road.
We're going to solve a missing persons case, which has haunted Orlando investigators.
So we're still waiting for that one person to come through with the one bit of information that could bring Jennifer home.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigative podcast looking into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessy from Orlando, Florida. I'm Sean Gerd. Last episode, you heard from Drew Kessy, Jennifer's father. We discussed the case and the realities and challenges the Kessy family has faced for the last 11-plus years of this investigation. Things that really, the rest of us can't imagine. But there's a particular part of our conversations that I wanted to focus on today: the details and circumstances that surround Jennifer's home, her brand new condo at Millennia. This was the condo that the Kessys lived in for months after Jennifer's disappearance. It seemingly became a command center in their relentless search for her. This was the condo where Jennifer was last known to be, as she spoke on the phone with her boyfriend on the night of January 23rd, 2006. Jennifer's disappearance, at least what we know of it, starts at her condo. And in some ways, it's also where it ends. Remember, a scent was followed by Bloodhound from the driver's seat of her abandoned car back to the steps just below her front door. And at that point, any relevant evidence, any sign of Jennifer, anything at all, completely vanishes. Needless to say, Jennifer's condo is of vital importance to this investigation. And if that wasn't enough, in the last episode, we also talked to Drew about a person we're referring to as the punch-out worker, an individual who's of great interest to us. And that person's interactions with Jennifer were at her condo. So we thought today it would make sense for us to focus on Unit 2226 at Mosaic at Millennia. It was late 2005, and Jennifer's longtime roommate was about to be married. Jennifer decided it was time to move into her own place. She decided on a one-bedroom, 782-square-foot condominium just steps from the world-class shopping and entertainment of the Mall at Millennia and its surroundings. The condo was officially purchased on November 17, 2005, and Jennifer had moved in just in time for Thanksgiving. It wasn't long after that Jennifer began mentioning things to friends and family that were making her uneasy. You probably remember her friends telling us about it in an earlier episode.
But she had told me over the phone on one occasion, just one time, when I had asked her how the new condo was. She said, along the lines of, because obviously it's been so long, it's great, I love it. You know, a lot of people are still moving in, and, you know, the workers just kind of give me the creeps. And I was like, I think I laughed about it. I said, what do you mean the workers give you the creeps? And she said, you know, they just stare at me and they holler and shout and stuff. And she kind of, like, then just let it go, like, disregarded it.
We also heard Joyce Kessy, Jennifer's mom, describe her worries as well.
You know, in the complex, Sean, there's so much that, I mean, in the complex, Mosaic, the Millennia, they had a lot of illegals working there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that from all of your investigation. And they were used to make catcalls at Jen, or they'd stop and leer, but they never said anything other than whistle. And Jennifer had told her friends, she had told some coworkers about it. Rob, her boyfriend, knew. And she had told us, and we told her that the next time it happens, go and talk to the sales manager and tell them what's going on. Because you should not be subjected to that. Nobody should be subjected to that in the place that's their home, you know, by workers.
And while we're taking a moment to go back to those earlier episodes, let's also refresh our minds on what Joyce had said about how they found the condo when they had arrived after she disappeared.
Plus, she had a lot of, you know, how most women have a lot of shampoo and cream rinse bottles in their showers.
Sure.
And she had a tub. So, you know, the corners where water collects when you're taking a shower,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't that the walls were wet. There was still water in the corners behind her shower bottle. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
She showered. The wet towel that she had draped over her washing machine. And then she had, you know, the underwear and the T-shirt that she wore to bed the night before on her bathroom floor. The contacts were out of her contact case. Her eyeglasses were left behind.
So with that fresh in our minds, let's add to that what Drew Kesey, Jennifer's father, shared with me in our conversations about her condo.
Sure. First off, it was a known fact that a full set of keys to every single condo in that place was stolen. The condo office had a key-making machine right in plain sight with a full box of blank keys right next to it every day of the week. There were, I think, two or three women that had the same problem that Jennifer had, people following them even to the extent, even more than Jennifer, honestly, very afraid within their own confines of their own home. As far as the locks of Jennifer, we had new locks, you know, beat me over the head, kill me as a dad, whatever it is. I said, Jen, we need to change locks. She's like, Dad, I just want to get everything set up. You know, what happens if you need to come in or somebody needs to come in or Rob has to, whatever it is that has the keys now. I don't want to go out and have to make keys. People are long distance that have keys, blah, 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 blah. Just let me get everything done and when I, you know, I'll get it done. I'm like, I want them up, Jen. I want them up. And we didn't get them up. Now, one thing that people should know is there was a rape button behind the headboard. Okay, so there was an emergency rape button in her unit. It was not used. But that was there in case something happened within the confines of her bed, if she could get to it. But the locks were not changed, and shame on me. Shame, I live with it every day. You know what I live with every day, Sean? I picked that condo for her. I live with that every day. I said, I want you here, Jen. This is the safe place. So, but I mean, that locks were not changed, and it's a mistake. Or maybe it's not a mistake. Maybe she would have walked right outside her door going to work, and that's what she was taking. But the locks should have been changed, period. Now, I always had a discussion with her, and Jennifer's the safest person, period. End of story. Jennifer knows every safety rule, anything you don't. There's no one safer than Jennifer. That's what surprises us all. And I always told Jennifer, you stick your chair underneath the door handle and they can't get. It's so hard to get through that. And she did it. She told me every night she did it. So, now there was a knock on her door that Monday night. And she believed it was her neighbor upstairs, who was a guy. She didn't answer it. Next door to her that we found out. Now, we lived in her condo 8 months after she was taken. It wasn't probably a month, 2 months that we were living there that we became aware that she had a pedophile living next to her. I'm like, there's no one in that apartment. Well, yeah, there's a pedophile living in that apartment. And when the detectives interviewed that pedophile the following morning, what was their response? Oh, yeah, he was so stoned, he doesn't know anything. Yeah, he's dead now. He moved away to Texas, and he's dead. He died.
In hindsight, it's clear that at the time of Jennifer's disappearance, there were red flags at her condo. We've talked previously about the things you just heard, about the construction workers and their interactions with Jennifer. She told friends and family about them, which is all the evidence needed to say that they were not normal interactions. You also heard Drew mention the keys and locks. Could that situation have played a part in Jennifer's disappearance? We want to share a story with you that, while not directly related to Jennifer's disappearance, might provide further insight into things that were happening back in 2006. We're going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and then you're going to hear from a former resident of Jennifer's condo building. Have you ever tried a Kind Bar? You probably have seen them in your local grocery store, coffee shop, or gym. They make delicious, healthy snacks using whole ingredients you can recognize and pronounce. So here's your special deal. If you're ready to try some tasty and healthy snacks, you can try 10 Kind Bars for free. All you have to pay is shipping. When you order the sample box, you'll also get to try Kind's Snack Club, where you'll receive monthly snacks at a discount and also get members-only bonuses. You shouldn't have to choose between your health and taste when it comes to snacking. That's why both award-winning chefs and nutritionists love and recommend Kind Bars. I tried their 10-snack sample box, and as I've said, the dark chocolate and nuts is still my go-to bar. I put it in my lunchbox every single week, and sometimes I snack on one after dinner as well. To pick up your free sample box, go to kindsnacks.com/unconcluded. That's kindsnacks.com/unconcluded. Thanks to Kind for sponsoring Unconcluded. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you help support this podcast.
I moved into the Mosaic in, I believe it was April or May of 2006, renting a furnished unit from a lady who had purchased a condo conversion there with my boyfriend at the time. And shortly after I moved in, driving through the parking lot, I saw a vehicle with posters on it regarding the Jennifer Kesey missing persons case. And I went up to the security guard at the front gate who let cars in and out and asked her about it, and she didn't have any idea what I was referring to. So that was a little alarming to me. We lived on that property from probably April or May, all the way through, I believe, about November of that same year. In the middle of the night one night, heard somebody trying to get in the unit with a key. We had the deadbolt on, so they could not get in with the key. Both my boyfriend and I were highly alarmed on this. We didn't act like we were just quiet. We didn't say who's out there or anything. Eventually, that person went away. We really couldn't see anything through the peephole. We waited about 15 minutes, went out the back sliding glass door because we didn't want to go out the front door just in case, and walked up to the front security gate area. And I noticed a, like, Suburban or a Navigator or some big vehicle at the gate with a gentleman and a girl in it. The girl was not Jennifer. I got a pretty good look at the two of them. And I asked the security person who they were, what was going on. It's a little vague about that night. I can't remember the rest of what the security person said. We didn't want to get involved. We didn't understand what was going on. Went back to the unit, got up the next day, went to the sales office, and asked the sales manager, I believe it was a sales manager, regarding why would somebody have a key to that unit? Why were they trying to get in? And he said that there were investors and realtors from the Miami area who came down to show the units and were had access to the units. And he was sorry that we were in the unit at the time they tried to enter. My boyfriend at the time didn't really like the answer, and I remember there being some sort of kind of, they were starting to get into an argument about it. I believe we thought that answer was very strange. They started to argue, it got heated, and you'll have to talk to him about the rest of that. I can't remember the outcome of that. There were construction workers in our unit on the property. There were landscapers in our unit on the property. I believe the developer of the units and the condo conversions could have been a company called Montecito. And I had purchased condos conversions from them in Florida prior in the same year of 2006. And also noticed during the condo conversion process, they had access to everybody's condos. They had keys. They did not want you to put your own locks on your front doors because they wanted access to your condos. And they had keys hanging in public view for anybody to really go get behind a desk. I believe after they finished the mold issue, probably a month or so after that, I'm thinking we moved out of that complex. I do remember being alarmed by the guys trying to get in, the guy in the middle of the night. I do remember talking to my boyfriend at the time about the Jennifer Kessie disappearance, and there was a time where I tried to call a hotline, and the hotline went into some vague, weird system, so I was never able to get this information out prior to...
The story is just one of several that we've heard or seen over the last several months. Many of them have been accounts of events that have been posted to online forums or message boards, and others have been emailed or left for us on voicemail. They paint a picture of exactly what we've heard. Jennifer's condo may not have been as safe as it seemed, but we already knew this. So, was it further confirmation of things we already knew, or was it something more?
I don't think you can rule it out. That's the thing. I think the fact that keys were so readily available and the fact that keys were stolen and you could just essentially grab one in the front office, to me that's a scary situation, and I think Drew alludes to that a little bit. I'm sure Jennifer was sort of worried a little bit too. And to me, I can't rule it out. In the back of my mind, I've been thinking about this for a while since you talked to Drew and everything. And
these are parts of a phone call that Scott and I had shortly after I'd talked to Drew.
I think it's a really interesting and a really, I don't know if the word is scary, but it is sort of a scary situation, especially for somebody who would have been living there at the time. For instance, the call that we had, and with Drew talking about how keys were stolen and keys were just readily available at the front. And of course, the caller talks about how somebody literally just had a key and was going to come into their place. I mean, I don't think you can dismiss that at all. It's too simple. And a lot of times with these cases, it ends up being the simplest explanation. And that just seems, it's right there. I mean, it's right there for us. And I really want to keep digging into this. I want to see if there was anybody else that had these situations. Was there somebody else? Like the interview that we had that experienced these same kind of things, and what were their experiences, and what were the explanations that they got. Clearly, there was a lack of control in that front office. You know, they could try to debate that all they want. Very clear with, again, repeating myself, the keys being stolen. Keys sitting right out in the front desk. I know they were going through a lot of different things there. They needed maintenance men that needed to have access to stuff. That's a scary situation, and that's just ripe for the taking for situations like this to occur. Not only the call that we have, but also with potentially a situation like we have with Jennifer. So I'm not ruling it out at all. I think I want to dig more into this. I think this could be something that starts leading us in a direction that, in my opinion, could get us some answers.
You heard Drew talk about the punch-out guy, you know, the construction worker guy that he had mentioned, and then also he was talking about the neighbor of Jennifer's that was like a pedophile or whatever. I mean, do you we can look at them as coincidences, but
they did at least a little bit of due diligence. They went in, they did a lie detector test, which I know, again, they're not really permissible in court, so they're not something that is 100%. I would love to have him spoken to again. I'd love for him to be interviewed again and really investigated. I think that at that time, or whenever this was, that he was you know, interviewed and polygraphed in jail, and he passed the polygraph. As an investigator, are you going to keep spinning your wheels? Are you going to keep digging into him? I think now that it's a number of years later, it might be potentially fruitful to go back. You might even get some information maybe about somebody else if you start digging in again. But I think as for him individually, I tend to think that we would be spinning our wheels as well if we continued to look at him and continue to investigate him, because I just don't know that. I think the police actually did go in there and do what they needed to do to, quote unquote, clear him from, you know, any sort of wrongdoing in this case. And as far as the pedophile that lived there, I'd love more information on him. You know, really all that we have is from Drew, and of course now we can't speak to him directly, but I still think there's other avenues to try to dig into it to see if there's any sort of connection. So yeah, I think there's still some room there to dig in and try to see what we can figure out.
What would be if I put you on the spot right now and I said, where was Jennifer abducted, what would you say?
The bottom of the stairs. That's where I feel like she was abducted. I think somebody was waiting there for her. At the bottom of the stairs, maybe this individual, if they had a key, had maybe been in her apartment once or twice, maybe to scope some things out. And then that, if you had to put me on the spot right now, that's what I would say. I'd say there was somebody waiting at the bottom of the stairs, either underneath the stairs, around that corner, and with the lack of the amount of people around there, if she left early enough. And as Joyce has said before, maybe some chloroform or something was used, or it was just one strong man or two that were able to subdue her. But that's what I would say. And I think that, you know, the dog scent adds to that credence of that theory. So I think that a lot adds up to that. Now, I wish I knew who it was, but if you had to put me on the spot, that's what I would say, is at the bottom of the steps that morning.
So what do you think about, and this is really going back to kind of when we first started, you know, looking into this, but have you changed your mind at all, or I guess narrowed down your opinion on whether you think Jennifer was abducted in the morning or at the night before?
You know, I think I have it narrowed down to it probably being the morning, but I just don't think, as much as I would love to sit here and say that I can rule out the night, I think people we've talked to, that we've interviewed, that have come forward, just can't push that away. And I think, you know, when I talked about it being at the bottom of the stairs, that could have happened at night as well. Very easily could have happened at night, under the cover of darkness, Matt, if she goes out that night for anything at all, who knows what it could have been. And I know she wasn't the type of person to put herself in danger, but maybe she felt comfortable just somewhere to meet somebody or whatever, I don't think you can rule it out. I still believe that things tell me that it probably happened in the morning at the bottom of the steps. But then, you know, you hear these interviews and it's just like, man, I don't know. It very, very easily could have happened at night and then could have been set up to look like a morning abduction. If the people had keys, that gives them a lot of time to do basically whatever they want, to make this thing look however they want it to look. So the key thing is big to me, and it still leaves the door open for nighttime or morning. And I know you'd like me to sit here and narrow it down a little bit more. If you put me on the spot, again, I would say in the morning. I don't think we can rule out at night either.
So have we learned anything new? For starters, I'd never heard previously that someone had rang Jennifer's doorbell the night before she was reported missing. And maybe it means nothing, but it's still interesting. And we also heard Drew mention a neighbor who was a pedophile, which, again, is something I'd never heard. And even though we've heard from people alleging poor security and shady construction workers, it seems that there could be even more there than we originally thought. So even though Scott and I are still going back and forth on things that we have been all along, about the time of the abduction, or the involvement of construction workers like the punch-out worker, I think it's clear that Jennifer's condo is ground zero for this whole thing. And so as we try to construct our theories or possible motives, it's all going back there. How does it tie in? Before we go today, I want to bring up something that was emailed to us by a listener just a couple weeks ago. It's something that Scott and I had also thought about previously. I'm going to read it to you. Dear Sean and Scott, I hope you both are well. Many thanks for doing this podcast. I first heard about Jennifer when I was on holiday in Orlando, the year she went missing, and worried about her ever since. I am in the UK, and so I feel frustrated that I can't help more. But I'm not sure what I could do if I lived in the US anyway. I just wanted to put a scenario to you. It may be ridiculous, but it's something I've always thought may have happened. Please feel free to debunk. I know the facts of the case, but maybe not, so apologies in advance. I wondered if it was possible that Jennifer, on the night of the 23rd, may have parked her car in a different parking space, maybe located by the pond, where it would be closer to the stairs leading to her apartment. She had several bags, a handbag, a briefcase, and luggage. This is something I would do, especially if those closer parking spaces were free. I am assuming this might be the case because of the complex being under renovation and not at full capacity. My scenario also assumes that she was abducted in the morning. She was taken in another vehicle, and her car was left behind. I then wonder if Mr. and Mrs. Kessie rang the building manager to check on Jennifer. The building manager checked her parking space, and they said her car wasn't there. If he didn't know what car she drove, he may just check the space and not be looking for her exact car. As he checks her apartment and then asks the workmen if they've seen Jennifer, this may spark chatter amongst everybody. If the person responsible are amongst the workmen and they hear people are looking for Jennifer, they may realize that they have to ditch her car because the police and family members will soon be on the scene. And if the car is there, then obviously the focus will be on the apartment complex. This maybe would answer why the tracking dog followed the scent to the stairs. Perhaps the person then got into a vehicle, after returning from the Huntington on the Green, and drove away, or was driven away. The Huntington on the Green apartments, just being far enough away so that it diverts attention away from anything happening at the apartment. This might also explain what the car was doing from the proposed time of the abduction to leaving the car at the Huntington on the Green. It may have been at the apartments, this person's talking about Mosaic, all along until it was moved. It could also explain the brazenness of the person of interest and that they already knew it was safe to drive the car, as the police and Jennifer's family were still on the way. My apologies if this is rambling, and I hope it makes sense. Many thanks again for the podcast. Jules. We wanted to share this email for a couple reasons. First is that it's not that far off from some things that we'd considered ourselves, but also because if we're going to be talking about Jennifer's condo, we also kind of have to consider her car, because we know that that car was typically parked in her parking space at her condo. How does it tie in? This particular email lays out a scenario that works for both a nighttime and a morning abduction. It also points out something that is one of those coincidences that I just keep thinking about over and over. Jennifer's car was seemingly parked at the Huntington on the Green not that long after Jennifer's parents had called the condominium to get the manager to check on her car and her condo. There's obviously no proof or evidence, but the timing is certainly curious. We're going to wrap it up there for today, and we'll continue our discussion on Sidebar later this week. Remember, if you think you may know something about the disappearance of Jennifer Kessie, anything at all, the time to come forward is now. Call the Orlando Police Department and ask to speak to the detectives in charge of this case. And don't hang up until you do. Music in this episode is by PC3, and we'll see you next time for our Sidebar follow-up episode.